welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 134, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And it's Play Expo London weekend.
Oh yes, we're going to the capital and this is retro gaming in the capital, finally. How long has it been?
Oh, we've been prepping this for at least 6 months.
Yeah, and I think we're still prepping it now, actually, and it starts tomorrow.
On the train on the way down. Yeah. But this is going to be, I mean, we've done so many of these, you know, big retro gaming shows, but I'm beyond excited for this one. I think we're doing about, what, 7 panels over the weekend?
Yeah, it's going to be a busy one, but hopefully we'll be able to have a play when we finish.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be play time after. So maybe you're listening on the way to Play Expo this weekend. If you are coming along to check out any of our panels and the show, do come say hello when you get a spare second, and maybe you're a new listener on the way back, you may have discovered us. We do seem to get a bit of an influx after a Play Expo, don't we? People have got the flyers and seen the panels and yeah, stuff that we do. So if you are new to the show, I mean, the way it works is Ravi and I, we do the show every week. 134 episodes now.
Every single Friday we're out.
We haven't missed one, have we?
No, not yet.
It's come close.
I think we have a break at New Year's, but that's all right.
Yeah, we have 1 week off a year. Yeah. But every week, I mean, the aim of this show is really because the world of retro gaming is a lot more active than a lot of people realise who are outside of it. And because when we originally started, you know, doing this podcast, we had that discussion, how often should we do it? And at first we're like, can we fill a show every week with retro gaming news? But since then...
Yeah, now we're cutting news because so much stuff is coming out. And what we like to do is we like to talk about the news here, but we also love to get a guest on and we love to kind of have it from the horse's mouth, you know. We get the stories directly from them. And this week's guest, I'm just astonished that we've got him on.
Yeah, well, this is David Brevik.
And yeah, he was basically the co-founder and president of Blizzard North and created the Diablo franchise, which, as you know, is probably one of the greatest games in history, as I'm told by a lot of people.
And you're a big fan, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. I loved it, but I also love the whole Warcraft series as well. And we all know how big that got. But David's currently got his own retro-style titles going on. So he's started his own company now, Greybeard Gaming, and he's gone back to designing, and he's kind of doing these cool retro indie titles. So we're going to explore that more as well.
And that is so interesting as well, the fact that a lot of the guests that we talk to whose career kind of started in the 80s and 90s, and then they went on to other things, a lot of them are actually kind of getting back into retro now, aren't they?
Yeah, totally. And also a lot of them are in similar circles. Like, we're going to talk about some companies like Atari and stuff that are related to the birth of Blizzard. You wouldn't have thought that, would you?
Yeah, and the Lynx and the Tremeils, clip art. How does that tie in?
Yeah.
So this is going to be a really interesting chat. David Brevik is our special guest on the Retro Hour podcast, and he'll be on in around 15 minutes from now. See, that's the thing. It's because we do get a guest on this show every week. And I was actually writing a bit about the show for an article the other day. Someone's kind of asking me about the podcast. And I did a bit of research. The video games industry, I mean, we've heard the talk that it's bigger than Hollywood and bigger than the music industry today. It's worth $100 billion worldwide.
It's crazy because there's also so many kind of assumptions done on the video game industry and not much fact-checking. And it's like, that industry's huge, you know. Yeah. I'm sure movies get kind of scrutinized a lot more than games and stuff.
Well, video games have only been around like, what, 40 years? So the advantage from our perspective doing a podcast like this is a lot of the people involved in the creation are still around.
Yeah, totally.
You're trying to do a movie podcast, you know, you're not going to get someone on from 100 years ago.
Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, good luck with that one. So do hang around. He's going to be really good. David Brevik is our special guest, and we have an entire archive. 133 other guests that are similar stature, massive names that you can look back and check out the full archive on our website, theretrohour.com. Now, doing a weekly podcast is a bit of a challenge sometimes. There is a lot to do. We're very busy guys throughout the week doing this, aren't we? Just take a lot of time up. And also, there's a lot of expense involved as well. So we do always appreciate any help that we get with the show too. Now, we do have a little tip jar on the front page of our website, theretrohour.com. That is where you can just go on there, throw in a couple of euros, a couple of dollars, a couple of pounds. If you enjoyed an episode, thrown in a fiver or something, that's really appreciated. And just for making a donation of any amount, you will find your place in the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. Now, this week, thank you so much to Robinson Technologies,
Simon Pilgrim,
Raymond Montalban,
and Ian Poynter,
who all made donations into the running of the show. And you can do the same. We accept PayPal, and that'll convert pretty much anything, won't it? Cryptocurrency as well. If you're into that, you'll find it all on the front page of theretrohour.com. Now, before we get into our guest, David Brevik, we do need to talk about this. How many tweets have we had over the last week or so going, have you heard about the Vega Plus?
Yeah, the problem is the news was so fast moving with it as well. And also, it's been going on for so long.
Well, I remember talking about the Vega Plus when we started doing the show in January 2016.
Yeah, so what's the kind of news? Because I'd seen that they'd been a few delivered,
yep.
But they were subpar quality. They were, there were some scratches on them. They had a bit of kind of cardboard in a Sinclair logo on them. They weren't to the standard that people expected. And it seems like they've been stripped of the Sinclair brand.
Yeah, it hasn't been a good week for them. Now, if you're not familiar with the project, I mean, it has been a talking point in retro gaming for, well, about 3 years ago, I think they originally went up on Kickstarter and Indiegogo, wasn't it?
Yeah, because it's been quite controversial, hasn't it? You know, yeah. People have received death threats. There's been quite a nasty thing, the whole thing has, to be honest, I think.
It's been a giant screw-up, hasn't it, from start to finish, really. I mean, this is, if you haven't come across this before, it's a handheld recreation of the Sinclair Spectrum that, of course, was one of the most famous 8-bit computers back in the day. Clive Sinclair, very popular home computer here in Britain especially. And they came up with this concept of having a handheld Spectrum where you could essentially play all the old games, load your own games onto it as well.
And it was officially licensed by Sky, who currently own the Spectrum brand, because they bought it from Amstrad.
Yeah, they bought Amstrad, who bought Sinclair, didn't they? through quite a few companies since then. But now, because so much has gone wrong with the Vega Plus project, Sky have essentially said to them, look, you guys are not professional enough to be carrying one of our trademarks. So they've now been stripped of the Sinclair branding that is actually right on the front of the console. So I imagine that's going to cause even more of a problem for them. Now, you think of this, though. They were originally meant to get delivered into backers' hands 2 years ago.
2 years ago. And this is the problem with Kickstarters and crowdfunding. I wouldn't say Kickstarters. I'd say crowdfunding. And the thing with crowdfunding is, you know, you can get promises kind of things, and it might not always deliver, and people put their hopes into things like these. So, you know, the way that they were presented, people were saying that they kind of didn't have any instruction manuals, charging cables. I've seen a lot of videos with people where it wasn't even wrapped in bubble wrap. No. It was just in a like bit of paper or cardboard in a loose box.
Well, there's a couple of retro listeners who've been, putting stuff out on Twitter and YouTube this week. I know a Chinny Vision, he did like an unboxing video, and at Lard's Lair, really good YouTuber, he'd actually did like an unboxing and kind of review of it as well, and he scathed the build quality. I mean, you mentioned there about the boxes, it kind of got delivered in what looked like a shoebox that someone had hit with a hammer. It was like, yeah,
I agree. But also, there is an upside, guys, which is if you do have one of these, bang it on eBay, because I've been seeing them go for ridiculous prices. So if you're disappointed with your Vega Plus, put it on eBay and you could probably get twice the money and go out and buy something decent.
Yeah, because, I mean, it doesn't look like a very well-made system at all. I mean, looking at, there's an article here on the Register, and some people are kind of speculating on there that maybe, you know, there was that much gone wrong with it, because you look back and, I mean, there've been stuff like, you know, court cases, the bailiffs have been called in, you know, all that have been going on with RCL, this company behind it. And some people are saying maybe they kind of just rushed and cobbled something together.
I'd think, why bother, you know? I think the project was so tainted and so messed up that whatever they delivered in people's hands, you know, they couldn't get it right.
Well, the things I've seen about this is, yeah, like you said, they've turned up with scratched screens, the screen flickers on it, the buttons are really hard to press. Yeah. There's only about 40 games on it, if that. It really has got, you know, scathing reviews from what I've seen so far. And, I mean, they claim that 400 of them have been put into the hands of backers, but, you know, according to this article on the Register, it's actually closer to 50, they reckon.
But have you seen the reviews?
Yeah.
Like, have you seen that some of the buttons don't even work?
Yeah.
With the kind of basic up and down and stuff like that, your D-pad doesn't work, your kind of product doesn't function, yeah.
And some of these, I mean, you know, looking at it, it looks like the buttons are actually hand-painted on it.
Yeah.
And the Sinclair stripes, the Spectrum stripes on there, they're just a piece of paper put underneath like
a
cheap screen.
House, someone in a house just kind of sticking bits of paper and painting on a thing. But the thing is as well, like, the firmware says Sinclair on it, right?
Yeah.
So I reckon these it's going to be a real challenge to remove any Sinclair branding.
Right, it's a death knell of it, surely. Yeah. Even if they have made all 4,000, which, you know, is still kind of in doubt.
I was amazed that there was still news coming out on it. And to be honest, I would have just killed it ages ago with all that bad press if I was those guys. But
well, I think the sad thing about it is it's the backers who really suffer here, isn't it? The people who've actually put the money into it.
It's the backers, but it's also the developers. Guys like Jonathan Cordwell that, you know, invested a lot of time into it and really good specy developers that kind of been sailed down the river, you know.
That said, though, I mean, the market is kind of there, I guess, if someone does want to come along and do it properly, who's got an established kind of name and history behind them.
Yeah.
There's a demand for it.
I think this is not going to, I don't know, taint other projects, but I think this is just going to keep happening with retro projects.
Well, I mean, you look at it and it's kind of like a lot of these companies maybe don't realise quite what is involved with manufacturing something and getting it into customers' hands. It's a lot of work, I imagine, and a lot of them maybe a little wet behind the ears, didn't really know what's involved in it, and maybe bite off more than they can chew.
Yeah, totally.
So the Vega Plus story, I think, is far from over yet. We'll be hearing more about it, I'm sure. But
I reckon those consoles are going to be worth an absolute fortune for collectors. You know, people will pay silly money for that. So all you disappointed backers.
Yeah. Especially if there's only 50 of them in the world.
I wonder how many are going to be on sale at Play Expo this weekend. We'll see.
Around a back alley, I'll give you this, $2,000. Yeah. There's only 49 of them more in the world. Now, Nintendo have been up to their old tricks again this week.
Yeah, going around and taking down things, which we know Nintendo love to do. But this is quite interesting because this emulator has flown under the radar for quite a long time.
It's been around since 2015, apparently.
Yeah, so it's a Java-based emulator, which is pretty cool. So you can, you know, emulate Game Boy stuff within your browser.
Yeah, JavaScript-based, yeah. So you can play Nintendo Game Boy games on your web browser.
Yeah, basically. But what they say is the reason they got around it was because they didn't host any of the ROMs themselves. They just hosted the emulator files. But I don't know if that contained, you know, Nintendo BIOS or something.
Yeah, I imagine the ROMs, I guess, would be Nintendo copyright. What's interesting is, though, that Nintendo is still fiercely defending the copyright of a system ROM that came out 30 years ago. They don't like anyone else getting their hands on any of their trademarks or anything really Nintendo, do they? Using them in any way that's not officially authorized.
Yeah.
As well, because, you know, the Switch hasn't even got a way to play all these games on there, their current console that's released. You could understand if they had, like, I mean, it probably is coming.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean. They're saying, you know, they haven't got retro games that are kind of on this system available at the moment, but they may be. And that's the whole thing. Emulating something that's currently for sale.
Yeah, that's going to cause problems.
Is that the correct thing to do? But also, what is fair use with a kind of system? And I guess it's Nintendo's definition of fair use.
Well, I mean, there are websites that have, you know, massive archives of, like, ROMs and everything as well, and all the games and everything are on there that kind of get left alone, which is a bit weird. But then you get something like this. Essentially was just a kind of, I mean, maybe it did use a copyright Nintendo ROMs. I imagine it did if it got took down by Nintendo. But again, all it was doing was providing a way for you to play games that you got elsewhere.
And on the flip side of that, like companies like Sega, who haven't been knocking out fan-made games and stuff, have now reaped the benefits with stuff like Sonic Mania, where they're actually working with these fan developers and bringing back the old franchise.
Yeah, well, that game probably would never have existed if they'd gone straight away to
Christian Whitehead, you know.
Well, I do think sometimes Nintendo do, like, cut off their nose despite the face, don't they? It's a bit like, I mean, I can understand you've got to be protective about your trademarks and all that, but sometimes it kind of feels like Nintendo are still stuck in, like, the 80s.
Totally.
That kind of,
I think the hardest thing in the world to probably upload on YouTube is Nintendo footage, right? You know, you could probably put some horrific stuff on there, but you couldn't put Nintendo footage. So.
Well, we did a Let's Play, didn't we, Christmas on the Nintendo Switch?
Yeah.
That got demonetized about 2 days after because it showed Mario Kart and stuff. I mean, they didn't take it down, but Nintendo, who probably need the, like, you know, £4 I'll make from the video. So, I mean, the good thing is there are lots of ways that you can play Nintendo games if you want to, but I think until Nintendo get this online service on the Switch and you can actually play these games, it is a bit harsh kind of cutting off people's emulators if they want to play the classic games that they had back then and bring back some memories.
Yeah.
So Nintendo, they're a very nostalgic company for a lot of people. You know, they want to revisit the past, and that's a nice way of
doing it. You seen this new Nintendo box where you can get kind of like Nintendo fan nostalgia merchandise sent to you every month?
No, what's
and you
this?
Get different types of stuff. I saw it online. It's like one of those loot crates.
Yeah.
but it's like a Nintendo fan special crate. Yeah.
What do you get in there? Like games and consoles
just
and stuff?
Like cards of like Mario and stuff, you know, like a little sweet case that looks like a Game Boy. So
you're really selling that well then, yeah?
Yeah. You can tell I'm not a Nintendo fan guy.
Haven't you got a, or you're planning to get a Switch to?
I've got a Wii U.
The Wii U's a great console.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. I still use that, yeah.
I've got every Nintendo.
Hacked it to hell as well.
I've got every Nintendo, well, not handhelds, because there's a lot of them. A lot of variants of the Game Boy around, isn't there? But I've got every Nintendo home system apart from the Virtual Boy.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for the N64 Mini so that I can play that on HDMI. That's what I want.
Yeah, I'll definitely get one of those. I love the N64. Now, Amstrad have been making the headlines this week.
This is hilarious because I found this and we retweeted it, and the actual guys who are doing this retweeted our tweet, which is really nice. And it reminds me a lot of you, Dan. So what this is an Amstrad PC for Hitching Festival, which is a small little festival.
It's a music festival.
Yeah, yeah, it's a music festival. And they've been using this old Amstrad and they've been printing the tickets still with it.
Yeah, for 25 years.
Yeah, yeah, in like 2018. And it's great for them because it's really cheap. But also, they kind of tweeted Lord Sugar, who is the old owner of Amstrad,
to tell him how reliable his machine was.
Yeah.
And he replied as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he actually replied, which is well cool.
So 25 years, they've worked out, they've printed 50,000 tickets on this old Amstrad PCW 8512. Now, this was a machine that came out back in 1985. And in this article, there's actually a picture of it. It's a green screen monitor on it. It's got a dot matrix printer connected to it as well. And they've had this machine running, printing tickets out for people that want to go to their music festival, for 25 years. Which, they've actually worked out the cost of this as well. Lord Sugar, he replied and said, "I can't comment if this is a world record, but it must be close." And it works out at 0.00798 pence per ticket.
Yeah, and that's the whole point that I was saying about you. So last year you were saying, I'm really using all this printer income.
Yeah.
And then you found your old Amiga, and what was the plan?
Well, originally I had a inkjet printer hooked up to my PC, wireless printer. And for some reason, I mean, I don't print a lot of stuff. And I'd hooked it up, printed something out, put it away for a couple of months, put it back out again, and the ink had run out. And you go to, like, you know, Staples or something, talking 40 quid for ink, aren't you, for an
inkjet
printer?
Yeah, I've got a HP and it's exactly the same. Yeah.
More than the printer normally, isn't
it?
So then my missus is doing like a degree at the moment, an online degree. She had to print out some stuff. Again, printed it a bit, we didn't use it for a couple of weeks, ran out of ink again, dried up or something, I don't know. So I thought, I've got this Amiga like printer that I used to use, a Canon bubble jet printer. Got it out of the attic at my parents' place. Turns out, ink for it is really cheap on eBay. I managed to get something like 50 ink cartridges for 50 quid.
Wow.
So to print letters and all that, it's fine though.
Yeah, for monochrome stuff as well, yeah.
But the big use for it was when I got married last year. Now for my my table, you know, the names on the tables where people are going to sit.
Yeah, yeah.
I was trying to do that on my modern printer. So it's these tiny little cards, and I had to print right in the middle of them. And trying to do that, we've got a laser printer now. Impossible to try and get it lined up. You try sticking it on a bit of A4 and moving it around and all that. Then I thought, I wonder if that Canon bubble jet can do it. Fired up Final Write in 97 on my Amiga. Loaded it through. You can actually get the head directly where you want to print it. Hit print and it come out.
There you go.
Saved the day.
And the thing is, it's so cheap. Like, guys, I recommend using dot matrix printers and stuff for all your just general stuff. And it can be like 0.1p a sheet or something.
Well, weirdly enough, we were in, because we've been going through a mortgage process recently, and we were in the bank the other week, and like my missus needed some bank statements printed out, and they print them out in a dot matrix. Again, because he said it's cheap.
Yeah, you know, that's it.
It's just a ribbon. And I mean, you can actually re-ink.
And those ink cartridges are absolutely everywhere. Yeah. You know, the old ones, people have supplies of like 60, 70.
And then if they dry up, you just put a bit of WD-40 on them or spray them again, it's like sorted. So
yeah.
And I do love the sound of an old dot matrix as well.
Totally.
But there, look at that Amstrad machine still kicking. Keep it there for another 25 years, I'm sure it'll keep going. Now, this is a really, really interesting company who you don't hear all that much about. Probably the most groundbreaking dead company in Silicon Valley. And we're getting a movie about General Magic.
Yeah, so General Magic were kind of within Apple Computer. They were a company based there. And the thing about General Magic is we've had a lot of films about you know, Steve Jobs.
Yeah, Apple, we've Microsoft.
Had endless films about Steve Jobs, but we haven't had the kind of people that invented the emojis, the guys that built the internet. And this film, I was just looking at a section of it, and they had, like, the CTO of Twit sitting with the guy who made Google Circles next to the engineering VP of eBay, BlackBerry and Samsung, also head of speech recognition. It's pretty much...
a hardware designer of the iPod and the iPhone.
Yeah, it's like the old Apple techs, you know, the absolute legendary guys that originally did the stuff, with all these fresh-faced young guys, and they're creating the internet. Like, some of the projects that came out of this, you know, Safari.
Yeah.
Like, they've got the VP of Google there. There's a founder of Nest sitting with the iPhone and the iPod hardware designers. So...
well, that's what all these guys went on to after General Magic, isn't it? But they did the foundations of what essentially became all of those projects while they were working there between 1990 and 2002.
Yeah. And it was kind of insane because General Magic were doing stuff like, you know, handheld wireless personal communicators.
Yeah.
You remember the Newton as well?
The Apple Newton, yeah.
Yeah, there's a big connection with the Newton there. But they also had full designs for emojis, user interfaces, all of this kind of stuff that's incredibly ahead of its time and kind of laid the foundation for the modern internet, really.
Well, I mean, there is a quote in this movie trailer, which I will put in the show notes at theretrohour.com. And the trailer's about 2.5 minutes long. It's going to be a full-length documentary movie, isn't it, all about General Magic?
Yeah.
But there's a quote right at the end of it where they're having a discussion and they say, you know, would Android today exist without General Magic? And they say, no.
Yeah, totally. And that's the thing. It wasn't Steve Jobs that did it all. Yeah. You know, there was lots of people around him, but all that innovation was also coming from Apple, which is just absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And having that hooked up with the Next.
Yeah.
And all of that,
it all kind of ties together, doesn't it?
It's crazy how everything ties together.
And it's awesome to see like companies like this who did, you know, maybe they weren't the most like front-facing, the ones getting all the media coverage at the time and everything, but these were the guys kind of behind the scenes in the lab working on all this technology that today is used everywhere. And it's good to see them getting recognition and a full movie made about them as well.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because you think in your head, like, where did eBay come from? Or where did, you know...
Well, is there a clip in there of, like, essentially the eBay, like, is it a guy who's at his PC at a desk?
On a desk, just with loads of checks.
And he's just manually putting them all through.
And they're probably walking by going, what the hell is he doing? No, auction site or like that. And he's like,
oh, we got another one in. I mean, yeah. You know what I mean? I've got a few more people.
I remember that, actually. My friend's dad was like, oh, I'm selling my violin on this on the internet. And we're like, are you mad? Like
that. No, no one's going
to
buy it.
I've got to send a check off to this place. It's this thing called eBay. I was like, what?
Yeah, before PayPal, you had to send a check in the post, my word. So, yeah, this is going to be a really interesting documentary. I mean, I love a good, nerdy computer documentary movie anyway. They're always really good.
That's it. And I think this one's going to be good because it's going to really focus on the tech and stuff like chip design, you know, modern modems, multimedia email, streaming TV, e-commerce, rather than the drama behind Steve Jobs.
Yeah. There's been enough of them movies for the last couple of years.
Ashton Kutcher. Oh, God.
Yeah, that wasn't the best one.
No.
So if you're doing to find out more about that, watch our trailer and everything else that we talked about in this week's show. We always put the stories that we talk about in our show notes. You don't have to Google around. We do it all for you. And you'll find those at theretrohour.com. Right then, it's time for the main event. This week's special guest, we're going to get really, really deep. Behind the scenes of Blizzard North, the Diablo franchise, how clip art is involved in this story as well. The Tramiels, loads of stuff in this interview, really good. David Brevik is this week's special guest. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast and it is time for this week's very special guest. It is our pleasure to welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, David Brevik. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, we are going to get into some really cool stories, I'm sure, about Blizzard North, Diablo. But before we get into all that, I mean, it's always nice to kind of find out where this adventure started for you in the crazy world of video games and computers. I mean, what was kind of your first experience with computers and video games? Where did it all begin?
The very first time that I ever played a video game was Pong. Which, you know, really dates me. But the that was the very first video game machine that I ever played. Even I had not played an arcade machine before that. So the, like a home version of Pong was the very first one. But really the kind of the desire and the magic really started to happen right when I started playing Space Invaders in the arcades. As you know, it wasn't really at an arcade. It was like at a sandwich shop down the street from me. And then the Atari 2600, that's when I, you know, the passion for video games really grew.
So was that your kind of first home console then, after the Pong machine, the Atari?
Yeah, Atari 2600 was my first home machine. And then my dad, I was fortunate enough that my dad ended up buying an Apple II Plus really early. I don't know, that was maybe like 78 or 79, somewhere right in that that time frame. I can't quite recall. And that's, you know, then I started teaching myself to program, and that's where the passion for programming really came.
Well, did that kind of drastically change your view of computers, being able to program instead of just playing the games on it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. You know, I was a game nut. I loved games all, you know, and I couldn't really buy games because I was a kid, so my parents would buy a limited amount of games. Like, I could get a game for like my birthday or Christmas or something like that, but it wasn't like I was just, you know, getting a game a week or something. So there were just very limited times where, and so I could, though, like, earn enough allowance and stuff to go and buy a magazine, and the magazine would have games in it that you could type in, and you know, it would have the complete program listing that you could type in AppleSoft Basic and play the games. So that was really like one of the ways that I started to learn how to program and learned and really developed a passion for gaming was copying this code out of magazines.
I remember doing that as well, and, like, you know, probably 90% of the time they wouldn't run first time. You had to go back. Yeah,
absolutely, and it was more like nearly 100% for me, mainly because there were a lot of times there were two big problems. One was that the data entry was really difficult because it would end up having like a series of just numbers that you would have to put in. And it was like, you know, 234, comma, you know, 36, comma, 19, et cetera. And then like this long chain of like, let's say 100 plus numbers that you would have to type in because it would make all these tables and sprites and stuff out of this data. And like, so I inevitably had typos in that little sequence of all those numbers. And then two, oftentimes the program itself just had bugs. So like they would just print these listings with bugs in them in the magazine. So I became very good at debugging not only applications but debugging my typos during that time. And I still use a lot of those skills to this day. I'm very good at debugging things, and I can narrow them down quickly because of all that experience I had when I was a kid.
Well, how did reading about Richard Garriott lead you to want a career in gaming?
So there was an article, and I don't really remember how I came across it because I wasn't really an avid reader of this magazine, but this kind of newspaper magazine, whatever you want to call it, that was kind of at the checkout counter called the National Enquirer, which is kind of a, you know, tabloid before tabloids, really. It was like the first tabloid, I guess. And there was an article in there in which Richard Garriott said that he had made $100,000 a year making video games. And I said, oh, my God, if you can make money making video games. And so I was like, it never even considered it a career possibility, or never even thought about doing it for a living until I saw that, oh my God, people actually, you know, it made total sense, but I never really put it together. And the fact is that, hey, $100,000 back in whatever this was, 1980 or something, was like, oh, that was an amazing salary. And so I said, wow, if that's true, then that's definitely what I want to do with my life, because I just love making games and working on them. So if I can make money too, that's all that I could dream.
Well, you're working for a clip art company as well. And I think, you know, often today people kind of forget just how important clip art was, especially before the internet was, like, you know, prevalent everywhere. Cause I remember getting floppy disks with clip art on. You'd use it in like your presentations or your schoolwork. What exactly did you do there?
Yes, that is true. Well, the clip art company existed. Like, I came on board after they had done several, volumes of clip art, and they did all the things that you're just talking about, like images of, I don't know, maps for presentations or flags or, you know, little, I don't know, whatever you would put in newsletters or presentations or whatever. And that business was not going very well. They had like overproduced a billion of, I don't know if it was a billion, but it was a lot. They way overproduced the amount of CDs. They weren't selling as many of that. So they ate up all of their costs in manufacturing these CDs, which cost, let's say, I don't remember, like $2 or to make a CD or something like that. And so they had spent thousands and thousands of dollars on this, and they weren't selling any. They were selling slowly, I should say. And so they were kind of at a loss with the business. It was in kind of dire straits, and they had all of these artists and said, well, if we get a programmer, we might be able to use these artists to make a game. So the owner, his family knew the Tremils, who owned Atari at the time. And through that connection, they were able to get an Atari contract to do an Atari game on the Atari Lynx, which was a handheld machine. And so they needed the programmer and got me and hired me to be the programmer. And then I worked with other artists there to create my first game. But the company, again, was not going very well and eventually went out of business. But the writing was on the wall pretty early for me, because my paychecks started bouncing about 4 months in. So, I knew it was time to kind of start looking for a new job pretty quickly. And I left there before I finished the project. But the project eventually got released. It was a game called Gordo 106, and you can find obscure things about it on the internet every now and then, people speed running it or something weird. Anyway, that's my first published game, technically, even though I wasn't there for finaling it.
And the Lynx was, I mean, everyone talks about the Game Boy and what a revolution that was, but the Lynx was kind of, it was streets ahead of it in terms of the power of the system as well. I mean, what did you think of the Lynx hardware?
The Lynx hardware was amazing. It was way, way, way ahead of its time, because at the time it was, Game Boy is what it was competing against pretty much. But it was color, and it had like you could, do things like adjust scan lines and like all sorts of had all sorts of easy sprite things. And it was easy to the processor was really easy to program on. And so everything about it was vastly superior to the technology in the Game Boy. They just didn't have any support or games or things like that, which has been the story of Atari ever since the 2600. Or they've even though they may have great hardware, they just never got the support or the IP that they needed to make a successful gaming company.
So I know it was that Dave Needle and R.J. Michael, the guys who invented the Amiga, pretty much went on to work on the Lynx, didn't they? Like the
correct, yes, yeah. Exactly. That's exactly right. And I was going to mention the Amiga, just like Amiga was way ahead of its time in a lot of ways. The same was with the Atari Lynx. It was incredible.
Well, how did this lead to you getting work with Iguana? And what were you first doing there?
So at Iguana, I became technical director there, but I started working, I was working here at this clip art company called FM Waves, and it was not going well. And so I started seeking for new employment. And this was like really early, like pre-internet times. So we would like go to the newspaper to find job listings. And there was a job kind of down near where I was living in San Jose. So I went over there and interviewed, and it was a little bit of a absent-minded professor. They wanted to hire somebody with experience, and I had a little bit of experience, but it was, just working on this one product. And I interviewed there probably 4 times, and every time I went to go interview them and show them the project that I had been working on, and I technically knew what I was doing, like I would forget something. I would forget a cable or something, and I couldn't show the stuff off. Like I kept forgetting something, and they're like, "Oh my God, this guy seems really great, but he seems a little bit like that absent-minded professor." And so eventually I got everything together, and then they hired me. And so I left FM Waves and joined Iguana Entertainment. And the very first project I did there was a conversion of an arcade machine, NFL, it's super high impact football, kind of a American football conversion from, it was kind of like NBA Jam styled football is about the best way to describe it. And it was a precursor to NBA Jam. And so I converted that arcade machine into to the Sega Genesis in 3 months.
And they were doing a lot of contracts for Acclaim, were they?
Correct. This was a contract with Acclaim at the time. And this was one of their first contracts with Acclaim. And Acclaim was super impressed with the job that we had done. It was like one of the very first projects that they had ever had that was on time and on budget. Like, you know, and then there was also the Super Nintendo conversion of the arcade as well. And that development company was like floundering. It was not. They were way behind our version, and so we looked even better because of the other dev kind of floundering and us getting it done on time. So that really led to quite a bit and a lengthy relationship between Iguana and Acclaim.
And I heard you accidentally turned down Mortal Kombat.
Well, yeah. So we had done this arcade machine, the super high impact football conversion, and Acclaim's like, well, this is really great. You know, you guys want some more work? We got lots of work that we would love to give you. And so we said, yeah, sure, we're interested in more work. And so the president of Iguana, a guy named Jeff Spangenberg, and myself, said, well, we got this new arcade machine. Why don't you go take a look at it? So we went and we played it. And I was like, oh, man, this game is great. This is going to be a big hit. You know, I think we should take this job and stuff. And Jeff's like, nah, I don't know, man. This game seems too quirky. This is, you know, it's too weird. I just think it's, you know, it's kind of silly with all the, you know, gore and stuff like that. And so he eventually turned that down, which was Mortal Kombat. And then, you know, he totally regrets that, obviously. And then later they came back and said, so we got another arcade machine that you should try. And so we went and played that one. And that was NBA Jam. And I said, oh, yeah, this is a really great game. This is also going to be a really big hit. And he said, OK, well, we're not turning this one down. And so we took the contract to do NBA Jam.
Well, how did this kind of close relationship with Acclaim make you want to start your own company and kind of break free of the Iguana?
The reason I left Iguana was because they moved the company from the San Francisco Bay Area to Austin, Texas. And I didn't want to travel to I didn't want to move to Texas. And so because I had done some work on, you know, for Acclaim, doing the NBA Jam work, started work on that, as well as doing the super high impact football. And also at Iguana had made this game called Arrow the Acrobat for Sunsoft. I was able to kind of get some work for hire from a couple different companies, from Sunsoft and from Acclaim. And that provided us with the, you know, the contracts to do extra development work. So I could create a development company. And so I asked two of the artists that I had worked with at the FM Waves clip art company, if they wanted to join me and start our own company, our own development company, and make games with just the three of us, or maybe we'd need more, but start out with the three of us. And they said yes. And that was Max and Eric Schaefer, the brothers that I had met at the clip art company, and myself. And we started our own development company called Condor, and Iguana moved to Texas, and we got the contracts to do a game for Sunsoft called Justice League Task Force, which is a fighting game starring the DC superheroes. And as well as from Acclaim, we were able to get a Quarterback Club, a NFL football game on the Game Boy and Game Gear. So we were able to get, you know, three contracts to do work right off the bat. So that that made the transition easy to create our own company, as well as, you know, kept me in the Bay Area.
Well, I was reading kind of about Justice League Task Force and the whole CES story with Silicon and Synapse. Could you tell us about that? Because that's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. We were offered several different jobs from Sunsoft. They wanted us to do the Aerosmith game, but we were not interested in doing the Aerosmith. They had like several choices, and one of them, they kept trying to push this Aerosmith game, and we decided not to do it. Instead, we really wanted to do this DC superhero game, which was a kind of a Street Fighter clone, but with the DC superheroes. And they said, okay, well, but you know, we're just making it on the Genesis. And we said, that's fine. We didn't need, you know, that was enough work for us. And so we went about making the Genesis version of this product. And then we would go to these trade shows. This was before E3 existed. We would go to the Consumer Electronics Show, which is this gigantic trade show here in the U.S. where they have everything from car stereos, TVs, refrigerators, and video games were a section of this gigantic show. And so we would just have our little video game setups right next to, you know, the car stereos as they blew us out, and their sound was way louder than our sound. And so we showed up at the trade show, and lo and behold, somebody else is making the Super Nintendo version of this game. It wasn't that they weren't making the Super Nintendo version. It just was a different developer had the contract. And we didn't know that another version of the game was being developed, and we didn't know that we had never spoke to the other developer or like had any kind of, you know, shared any notes or anything like that. You know, there was no idea that this other version exists, and same for them. They didn't know that the Genesis version was being created. And we show up at the show, and the games are kind of strangely similar, which was bizarre. I mean, like, even some of the artwork and things like that and the locations and stuff that we chose were similar to theirs. Our moves were kind of very similar to each other and whatnot. So we kind of just got to talking to them, and they're this development company called Silicon and Synapse. And we kind of hit it off with them. We had a good time, and they're like, oh, yeah, we're doing this work for hire stuff, but we really want to make PC games. And so we've got a PC game that we're kind of, you know, showing off behind closed doors right now. And did you want to see it? And I said, yeah, that sounds great. And we went to go look at it. And that game was Warcraft, and it looked great. And so I kept in touch with them. And as we got closer, they said, oh, yeah, in the fall, they said, yeah, we sold our company to a different company. We changed our name to Blizzard, and we're going to make, you know, mainly PC games. And here is here's our first offering. I said, well, if you want anybody to test, you know, we got eager people here that would love to give it a try. And so they sent us a bunch of, they sent us a build or whatever, and we gave them feedback and really kind of kept in touch with them. And that led to the kind of relationship between Condor, which became Blizzard North, and Blizzard Entertainment.
It's weird how the stars align sometimes, though, isn't it?
It's bizarre. I mean, it's so strange. If you think about all of the, like, twists and turns in my career that led to the creation of what eventually became Diablo, like, the way that this, like, all of these things kind of aligned is bizarre. The fact that the owner of Iguana got married and moved to Texas, like, then I created a development studio. The fact that we were both working on these projects for this publisher that didn't, and we show up and the games are similar and we get to talking, and, you know, that leads to this relationship which, you know, leads to Diablo, and like all of these weird coincidences that happen to exist to lead to the road of the creation of Diablo.
And was it true that they were in the kind of world of edutainment before?
Davidson and Associates, the company that bought them, was kind of the leader in educational entertainment software, and they were number one. So they were kind of branching out. They kind of dominated that market, and their growth potential then was, okay, well, why don't we just make traditional games as well as educational games? And so they bought this developer, Silicon and Synapse, because they had gone and created some games that started winning awards, like Rock and Roll Racing and some other games that they had made. So they were kind of a standout developer. And they said, well, we'll acquire these and make them the cornerstone of this new division of ours that was focused on entertainment.
I love the fact that two of the biggest game franchises in history came out of edutainment and clip art, essentially. That's crazy.
Yes, it's strange.
So what was it like the first time you saw Warcraft 1?
Oh, my initial impressions were this game looked fantastic. It was right up my alley. I mean, this was very early RTS time. There was only one other game that you could call maybe an RTS, which was Dune 2000. But so here was kind of a fantasy version. So I love that it was fantasy. I love the orcs versus humans kind of take on it. And I loved kind of the real-time strategy building stuff. I thought it looked great, and the graphics, you know, were awesome, and the sound was fantastic, and all these things. So my first impressions were I was super impressed with what they were making, you know, and that really kept the line of communication open between the two of us. Like, we kept going back and forth and talking about that game, kind of brought us together. After they had finished, when we were in the fall and we were kind of communicating back and forth and talking about Warcraft, we said, well, we got a great PC game idea that we've pitched to a lot of people, but nobody will listen to us because RPGs are dead. They said, well, we're looking for more companies that, you know, our directive is we've got to make more games. That's what we've been, you know, we were bought to make a bigger division. So if you guys have a game idea that we like, we'd love to listen to it. So after we finish Warcraft 1, we'll come out and you can pitch us your game. So they finished Warcraft in December, and then in January they came out and we pitched them Diablo in January, and they loved the game idea right away, which was great because we had gotten rejected so many times before that with our concept that I just kind of had a gut feeling that this was going to be a good process and that we were going to we got along with these guys really well. And so it was like, it seemed like this was a natural fit and they liked us and we liked them and they liked our game idea. And it just felt like the right kind of choice.
So how controversial was the real-time phone call you got, and how divided was the office, whether you should have a turn-based Diablo or a real-time version?
Right. Yeah, it was incredibly controversial, mainly because of me. And so I loved the turn-based feel that we had, not only that we had, but these types of games had, like Rogue and Morian Angband, things like that, NetHack. All of these games had really great turn-based mechanics and tension, and I wanted to capture that with Diablo. So they called up and Blizzard South, you know, and they had done kind of this, hey, we're taking strategy stuff, we're making it real time. We think that you should do the same thing with Diablo, take it, you know, from this turn-based thing to a real-time thing. And we were doing our it was turn-based, but it was kind of a complicated turn-based. Like, it wasn't my turn, your turn, my turn, your turn. It was different turns took different amount of times. We can call it, you know, tenths of a second, or you can call it frames or whatever you want. But like, you know, moving diagonally took 1.4 seconds and horizontally or vertically took 1 second. And swinging your sword may only take like 0.2 seconds or whatever it was, you know. It was turn-based, but it was kind of like there was different weights to your actions. And they said, well, you know, it's really, we really think that you should try it. We think that it'll make a big difference. And I just really didn't want to lose that kind of tension. There was nothing more tense in my life than the experience of doing this turn-based combat where I've been playing this character. All of these games, these Rogue and Morian Angband stuff, were permadeath games. So you died in the game, your character died in the game, that was it. The game was over, and you lost everything. And so, making these turns, and you're getting down to the end, you find yourself in a stuck situation. You're like, oh my God, I'm running out of time. This is a disaster. What do I do? and you know, you would get up from the computer, you'd walk around the lab. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to lose like this 2 weeks of work on this character. It's the highest level I've ever gotten. I can't believe this. I'm in deep doo doo at this point. And and so you would plan out all of these things and look at your equipment. And like, there was this intense period of time where you're kind of agonizing over which moves you were going to do. And that's inevitably you died. You know, it was very sad, and your character was deleted, and you didn't play for 3 days as you calmed down, and then you come back and play again. But I loved that feeling. I loved the intensity of that. And I thought real time is just not going to have that, right? You're not going to have this moment where you're like, oh my God, I'm about to lose everything here. I've got to really think this out. And is there anything I can do to kind of give myself the best odds I can of succeeding? And so I didn't want to lose that kind of spirit. And so I was very adamant that I did not want to do this. And so we started talking about it as a group and the office, and people started hearing more and more about it. And everybody, pretty much everybody in the entire office was in favor of changing it into real time, or at least giving it a try. And eventually, I was still pretty stubborn about the entire thing, but I was democratic. And so we got together in the kitchen, and everybody got a vote, and we voted whether or not that we wanted it to be real time, or turn based. And the vote was overwhelming, 80% plus of people that wanted it to change to real time. And so I said, okay, well, we'll give it a try. And then so I called up Blizzard, and we were still kind of work for hire at this point. You know, we had signed the contract to do Diablo, and we weren't Blizzard North at the time. And said, well, yeah, we can do this, but it's going to take a lot of time and work and stuff. And so we need a little extra money to make this massive change. And so they agreed to a little bit more money. And I said, okay, well, we'll do that. And so, I came in the office on Friday, and I said, okay, we're going to make this big change. Everybody come back, everybody go home. We'll come back on Monday, and we'll have it running. And so, or at least have a prototype or whatever, but there's nothing for anybody can do while I make this massive change. So everybody left, and then I completed the work in like an afternoon in a couple hours, and changed it from turn-based to real time. And again, I've said this many times, but I can still picture it. It's like one of the most clear moments of my career where I was playing this warrior, and I clicked on a skeleton. I walked over. He like walked over and he bashed the skeleton. As soon as I clicked, he walked over and he smashed the skeleton, and it felt so good. I was like, oh my God, it was incredible. The sensation, the experience was, again, it was like, you know, the heavens parted and the angels sang and like the light shone down into the office kind of thing. I mean, it was like, oh my God, this is just so incredible. It was just night and day. Obviously, how could I have ever thought that turn base was the right thing? I instantly had flipped. It was obvious that this was going to be a winner. This was something magical, and so from that moment on, we never looked back. And kind of changing it from turn base to real time was just an incredible stroke of luck and genius that made it something that makes Diablo stand out forever.
Well, even when Diablo, you know, was in development generally, I mean, the technology landscape was changing so much around that time in the mid-90s, even the launch of, like, Windows 95, new graphics cards seemed to come out that were, like, 10 times better than the week before every couple of weeks. I mean, did the rate of technology change at the time influence your development?
Yes, absolutely. There were all sorts of things that did. One is that when we started out, it was going to be DOS, and we changed to Windows. 95 came out, and we changed to Windows and DirectX. So we, you know, gone were the days of DOS and you having to, you know, use extended or expanded memory and like what IRQ is your sound card on, and like all of these like nightmares that was almost impossible to install anything or play a game on the PC. And so like getting rid of all those things and getting rid of, like, there were 87 million different standards for video cards and how they access their memories and things like that. So unifying that with DirectX was just incredible. That really made a huge difference. So that technology was big. And then also, the internet really was becoming the full-fledged internet and people starting to play games over the internet. And we thought about, at the time, hey, what would be really cool, us as gamers, is thinking it'd be really cool if we could not just play like a LAN game, because we had done some LAN stuff with Warcraft 1 and Warcraft 2, but it would be really cool to be able to connect with my friends all over the U.S. Or world and play together. And to do that right out of the box so that you didn't have to get on some kind of weird service, because there are services popping up where you could matchmake with other people around the world or whatever. But we wanted that experience to be right, something built into the game. And so we invented Battle.net and created Diablo, made Diablo into a multiplayer game using this Battle.net technology about 6 months before the game shipped. And it turned out to be, you know, the advent of this internet play and DirectX and Windows and like all of these kind of things we were right on the kind of cutting edge of technology at the time.
Well, the Hellfire expansion came out, which was with Sierra, and I know that's a very kind of love it or hate it kind of expansion. What was the story with that and how did you feel about it?
I was very displeased. It came out because we'd finished Diablo and we said we're going to work on Diablo 2 because it was, you know, there was so much cheating with Diablo 1. We really wanted to fix that. And there were some other things that we were like, we can really improve upon this product. And so we went on to go start working on Diablo 2 and improve what we thought were some of the flaws with Diablo 1. And meanwhile, the publisher, you know, our owners, at the time, they originally started out to be Davidson and Associates, but then this other company called CUC ended up buying both Davidson and Associates, which owned us, Blizzard, as well as Sierra Online at the same time, like nearly like within days of each other, they had bought both of these companies and made this giant entertainment and educational entertainment company. And so we were kind of, Sierra Online and Blizzard were the same company for a little while. And so the publishers, the people at CUC said, hey, you guys have really hit it out of the park with this Diablo thing. We would love to sell an expansion. But you know, you guys, how do you guys feel about that? And we're like, well, we're too busy working on Diablo to do an expansion. They said, well, we've got teams that would make a Diablo expansion over at Sierra that aren't working on anything right now. How would you guys feel about them doing an expansion? We said, well, okay, that sounds fine. But we've got to have like a lot of input and a lot of creative control and things like that. Final says and all that stuff. Yeah. Okay, fine. And so they sent us, they went on working on it. We got a producer here, at Blizzard North it was his job to kind of make sure that they were, you know, getting our feedback and doing the changes that we were supposed to be, that we wanted and et cetera, et cetera. And it wasn't really happening. They weren't making the changes that we were requesting and they just kept doing their thing. And Sierra and, CUC and Sierra or whatever ended up, you know, publishing it without my permission when I didn't feel it was ready, nor did it keep really in complete theme with the Diablo universe that we had created. And they released it anyway because they wanted to make some money. So they had numbers to meet, and rather than do our changes, they decided to release it. So I was very upset about this. You know, unfortunately, a lot of people lost jobs and stuff over it. It was a bad fight. In the end, it never really came out to be the way that I wanted it to be. And ever since that, we decided we would never do a request for the publisher again. that was just about money. It was kind of a tough lesson learned.
Yeah, because one thing that I looked at as well was the Warcraft Adventures, and that was actually co-developed by the Animation Magic guys who did those infamous CDI Zelda games.
Right.
Why did you kind of decide to can that? Was it to keep the standard of Warcraft quite high?
Yeah, that was basically, you know, we had been working on it and they had designed it and they were kind of doing a good job or whatever. Everything was going well, except for the game just was not very good. It was, you know, it was not, the story was interesting, but the quality level, there was nothing there. Like, it was a very standard, you know, adventure game. And there was nothing revolutionary or different or exceptional about it. It was just kind of a middle of the road / slightly below that adventure game, and which there was generically 8,000 of these things at the time. And it didn't really do anything to kind of make it stand out from. And so one of the things I had talked about with Alan myself many times was that one of the things that we kind of decided early was that there are kind of different roads that we can go as a game developer and as a company. But the road that I want to take is I want to be the Ferrari of the video game industry. I don't want to be the GM of the video game industry. Both are, you know, fine ways to go. I just want to make exceptional games. I don't want to make lots of games. And so that decision kind of fueled a lot of important things later to keep the Blizzard quality really high. And nothing was acceptable unless it was of the highest quality. And so that's really how Warcraft Adventures, like, I came to the team and talked to the guys down south and said, guys, we gotta cancel this project. It's just not going well enough. It's just not living up to our standards. And after some reflection, they agreed, and it ended up getting canceled.
Well, speaking of exceptional games, I mean, I remember reading reviews at the time that Diablo 1 was like the best video game ever, and then 2 came out and cancelled it and took its title. And I mean, even after a decade, it was still in the top 10 after release, wasn't it? So, I mean, how did the changes in technology help with that game then?
Well, actually, they hurt us more than anything at the very beginning, I think. The technology, obviously, was rapidly evolving at the time, and this was kind of the dawn of the era of like 3DFX video cards, 3D video cards, and so a lot of people were converting their games to using polygons and doing 3D art and 3D worlds and stuff like that. But we wanted a much higher fidelity on our graphics in terms of we really wanted them to look better than you could make with 3D stuff. The 3D stuff was pretty rudimentary at the time. You know, it was like, let's say, trying to make a tree out of 25 polygons or whatever. It just didn't look very good. And so, you know, if we wanted to have lots of trees in this rich world, we had to stick with sprites. So in some ways, we got kind of dinged when Diablo 2 came out, because it wasn't 3D, and we were kind of behind the curve then technology-wise in terms of graphics. That said, I thought our graphics looked amazing, and they still hold up today, where I don't think that if we had used, you know, low-res polygon stuff, it would be nearly the kind of way that people look at it and remember it fondly now. So I think that some of the technology hurt us. That part of it was maybe a bit of a hindrance, but there was plenty of other things that went our way and was really helpful. And mainly it was technology of things like putting, you know, changing Battle.net into a client server model so that we could control the servers and people could play online, and we could really curb the cheating. In theory, you can eliminate the cheating, but we learned a lot on how not to do it when we were making Diablo 2 and how not to do client server, because we just didn't know any better. It was our first time that we had been doing that, and so there was still cheating, but we were able to kind of plug up a lot of the holes eventually and get it to be a very kind of cheat-proof environment.
Well, my understanding was that the kind of Diablo 1 and 2 team did a build of Diablo 3, I was wondering how much things changed in the development and what kind of caused people to leave Blizzard.
Well, that's a big question. Yeah. Yes, we were working on Diablo 3, and we were working on it. It was originally designed to be an MMO, but not like an MMO like World of Warcraft or EverQuest or anything like that. I know as soon as you say the words MMO, everybody instantly thinks, oh, it's going to be just like World of Warcraft, but with Diablo characters. But that it was nothing like that. It just means massive multiplayer, meaning lots of people online together, playing together. So a little bit more like Path of Exile than it is World of Warcraft. So, but it was even more of a of multiple people running around in this world together, you know, all over the lots of people in your particular zone and things like that. So it was still the same Diablo perspective, same Diablo kind of action and whatnot. But it was going to be thousands of people in the world playing together. And so we started working on it. It was a 3D game. It was going to use 3D graphics and models and stuff. And we started work on it. And then we left. We had had a fight with the owners. There's a long history of the ownership of Blizzard. We had, like I had said earlier, CUC had bought Sierra Online and Davidson Associates. CUC then merged with this company called HFS to become this company called Cendant. And Cendant was basically the most corrupt company in like the history of Wall Street in the 90s. Oh, wow. It was the Enron of the 90s, they had totally fabricated all their books. People went to jail. Like, I mean, it was a complete disaster. So that company owned Blizzard Entertainment, and then they sold the thing in kind of a fire sale to a French utilities company, a water company called Vivendi. That had changed from being just a utilities water company to being a they wanted to be a communication a superstar. And so they went out and bought all of these companies, racking up the biggest debt in European corporate history. And we just got sucked into this French water company. and they didn't know anything about making video games. And so they are trying to, you know, get us to do things that we didn't want to do. And it was just like this constant fight. And then it like started to go out of business, and then they were selling all of their stuff. And so like we were as Blizzard North, we're having all this success with as Blizzard from Diablo to StarCraft to Warcraft, and like things were just going so well for us, but everything above us was just this gigantic disaster. And so we were fighting and fighting and fighting all the time with the ownership. And it's just like I eventually it just became a quality of life thing for me. Like I was just so stressed out, so upset on a day-to-day basis that eventually, after trying to work it out for years, decided I just couldn't do this with my life anymore, and I had to, you know, I had to move on. I couldn't really be a part of this kind of environment. It was just not good for me personally, for my health or anything like that. So it was kind of time to move on. So we left. They ended up getting years later now, they ended up, you know, Vivendi still owns the whole thing, and they ended up being pretty good owners, and they ended up working it out. But I just didn't have the stomach to do it. And so we had left and made Flagship Studios. And that was at the beginning of development of Diablo 3. And then it changed radically to the way it became when it was Diablo 3 was released. None of really almost anything was, in fact, I don't think there was a single design thing that was kept in the Diablo 3 that was in the final Diablo 3 besides it being a 3D game.
So later on, you went into quite a few companies, actually. You did a Flagship, and then you got into Gazillion as well, and ended up becoming CEO of there.
Yeah.
Most recently, you've kind of joined the indie games revolution, and you've gone back into designing. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So I, like you had said, I started to be the creative director on Marvel Heroes at Gazillion, and doing basically a Marvel Diablo game, and I was really loving that, but the company that I was working with had all sorts of problems, and I kept helping with, you know, solving some of the problems and stuff like that, and people kept noticing, and eventually they kept promoting me, and eventually I became CEO of the company, which is exactly what I didn't want to do, right? Like, I keep getting promoted to being the president or CEO or whatever. This has happened at Blizzard North. It happened, you know, at Flagship Studios. It's happened at Gazillion. And so I said, okay, that's it. I became CEO. I was CEO for several years, about 3 or 4 years. And then I said, okay, that's it. That, you know, I've done the CEO thing. CEO job, when you've got hundreds of employees and stuff like that, is like, I'm not working on games. You know, I'm out talking to investors and making presentations and doing all sorts of stuff like that. That isn't game development. And when I was a kid, I said, you know, what really makes me happy, what really drives me, is being creative and working on games. And so when I was a kid, I said, I don't want to grow up to be a CEO. I want to grow up to make games. And so I said, okay, I've done CEO for a while now. The company's in good shape. I'm going to, you know, leave and get back to making video games and being a developer rather than running companies. And so I left and I started this company called Greybeard Games and said, I'm going to make a small team, you know, 5 people or something like that, less than 10. And we're going to do a little game together and whatnot. And so I started working on some prototypes and some ideas that I have. I always have like 8 different ideas, but I really kind of tested different theories out and tried different ones. And I really settled on one that I liked a lot and started working on it and realized that it was too big of a game. I had come from making all of these different projects with many different people. And so here I was like, well, this is too big of a game for a little indie dev company. So I had to kind of like take a break and take a step back and think about how to make a game with just a few people. But the more I did that, the more that I talked to some of my friends and things like that, and realized that, you know, maybe 10 was too big. We could probably do this with like 5 people, even better, right? Because then, you know, the larger it is, the less chance I have of actually doing the work. So let's think in the 3 to 5 range. And I started talking to even more people and realized, you know, I think I can do this with just myself and an artist. So I started working on some stuff, and I started making, you know, if we did a retro style pixel art thing, then I might be able to, you know, just get away with myself and an artist. So I started working on it, and I started making some prototypes, and I started working on my pixel art, and I was like, you know, I think I can do this all by myself. And so I've gone from the extreme of being CEO of a company with hundreds of employees to making a game by myself, which is what I'm doing right now with a game called It Lurks Below. And it's just myself. I'm doing the art. I'm doing the music. I'm doing the programming, the design. I'm doing it all, community efforts, everything. And I'm really, really enjoying myself.
Well, It Lurks Below is available on Early Access on Steam right now. And it looks fantastic. I mean, I'm just looking through some of the features that are in here as well. What's kind of been the feedback from gamers in the community so far on it?
Oh, so far, the feedback has been incredibly positive. People are very addicted to the game already. It's basically, it is Diablo from the side. So it's kind of a side view Diablo. So it's got a little bit of like a kind of Terraria mining, you know, whatever Minecraft Terraria kind of style to it, and that you're doing some mining and crafting and stuff like that. But mainly it's, you know, a dungeon filled with monsters. You're down there, you're fighting the monsters, you're getting random loot, you're, you know, changing out your items. There's uniques and different rarities of items and rune words and like all these kind of things. So it's got a little bit of that, a little bit of the kind of a survival features. It's got some farming and crafting and things like that, but mainly it plays and feels and very much like Diablo. It's very action oriented, and there's lots of randomness associated with random dungeons and random monsters, random items, and all that kind of stuff, so you can play over and over again. And there are many people in the early access that have 300 plus hours of playtime already, and So people can get quite addicted to it and are having a really good time.
Well, I think everyone that's listening will want to try. It looks below. So I'll put a link in our show notes if people want to get access to the early access on Steam. And David, it's been wonderful getting these stories as well. It's just great to hear that you're back to doing what you love as well. So thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for this opportunity. It was a lot of fun.